Welcome to Module 6 of the High Performance Instructional Leadership Certification Program. In this module, we're going to talk about evidence, which plays an incredibly important role in your conversations with teachers, as well as the formal evaluations that you conduct of their practice. We generally think of evidence as something we prepare for other people. For example, you might use evidence to help a teacher accurately rate him or herself on a rubric. Or you might use evidence about a teacher's practice to convince your supervisor or superintendent to pursue the dismissal process. You also use evidence to convince other people of good things, like when you're nominating a teacher for an award or writing a recommendation letter. But there's another audience for evidence, and that is yourself. When you make evidence a central part of your decision-making process, several important things happen in your instructional leadership. First, you can be confident in your judgments. When you've rated a teacher as, say, unsatisfactory based on evidence and a rubric, you can be confident that when other people review your evaluation of that teacher's performance, they're going to agree with the conclusions you've drawn. So any suspicion that you might have a personal vendetta against that teacher or that you're being unfair is going to be minimized. And for you, this serves as a powerful motivator. Often, administrators treat the teacher evaluation process as little more than a formality and don't really expect it to result in improvement or dismissal, even for the most seriously underperforming teachers. But when you know your evaluation's going to stick, it becomes worth the effort. And make no mistake, teacher evaluations are always a lot of work, and using the evaluation process to get rid of an underperforming teacher is an incredible amount of work. We'll talk more about the formal evaluation process in Module 7, but for now, suffice it to say, evidence is essential. Second, when you use evidence effectively, your evaluations largely write themselves. After you've documented teacher practice and aligned that practice with your evaluation rubric, your work is mostly done because you've done the hard work up front. Third, when you use evidence effectively, you build trust with your staff. You can have better relationships with the teachers you supervise when they know that you'll be fair to them in the evaluation process. There's no better way to have a fair and transparent process than to have clear evaluation criteria, as we talked about in Module 5, and clearly documented evidence that you've talked about in depth with the teacher, which we'll explore in this module. Fourth, when you consistently rely on evidence, you can depersonalize your feedback because it becomes about the practice, not about the person. Teachers naturally take their evaluations very personally. When you evaluate a teacher's practice, you're evaluating something that's at the core of their professional identity, their sense of competence. But if teachers have seen the criteria and they've seen the evidence for themselves, and they have experience using the language of your instructional framework to talk about that evidence, then your final rating won't come as much of a surprise. That doesn't mean they won't still take it personally, but it means they'll stand a good chance of realizing that it's more than just your opinion. Finally, when you make classroom-based evidence a core focus of your work as an instructional leader, everything else you do becomes more effective. The decisions you make can be based on actual evidence and not just assumptions or teacher self-reports about what's happening in classrooms. When you know what's actually happening in your school, you can lead that work more effectively. So let's get started. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you in the next section. Let's talk specifically about how to take notes to gather evidence during your formal and informal visits to classrooms. First, I'm going to recommend that you avoid the term evidence when you're talking with teachers because it sounds too formal and forensic. We don't want teachers to feel like they're on trial, so when you're referring to the evidence you've collected, don't call it evidence. Just call it your notes about what happened in the lesson. Second, if you're following my plan for your first three cycles of classroom visits, as I outline in my book, Now We're Talking, 21 Days to High Performance Instructional Leadership, you know that in your first two cycles of visits to classrooms, I recommend that you not take any notes at all, but instead focus on getting teachers and yourself comfortable with your increased presence in classrooms. Until your third visit, just show up and pay attention. Don't bring a laptop or a tablet or a clipboard or anything else. Taking notes will increase teachers' anxiety. So while it's important and we can't put it off forever, we do want to work up to it. Third, when you do start taking notes in your third cycle of informal visits or in a formal observation, keep your notes low inference. Rather than add reflective questions and suggestions for improvement and other commentary, keep your notes strictly descriptive and factual. The main reason to do this is that it'll give you more flexibility to adapt your approach as you learn more about the whole iceberg, as we talked about in Module 4, and in the moment, you might come up with a question or comment that you later discover isn't helpful, and that means you'll have to edit your notes before you share them with the teacher. So instead, keep it simple and save the commentary for your conversation with the teacher. Remember, the success of the lesson depends a great deal on what the teacher's goals for that lesson are, and you don't always have a good sense of that until you talk with the teacher. So just keep your notes literal with as many verbatim quotes and factual descriptions as possible. That way, whatever happens and whatever your ultimate conclusions are, you'll have the evidence to support them without the clutter and distraction of comments that may turn out to be off topic. Fourth, share your notes with the teacher immediately. If you keep your notes to yourself, that's only going to increase the teacher's anxiety and decrease the level of trust teachers place in the process. Think about it. What's a teacher's worst fear when an administrator shows up and starts taking notes? It's the fear that you'll think they're not doing a good job, and even worse, that you're compiling a secret file of evidence that you can use against them. And of course, you are compiling evidence, but that's a much less scary situation for teachers if they have a copy of everything you've written down. So I recommend that you email your notes to the teacher immediately, on the spot, before you even leave the classroom. You can take your notes directly in your email app, or if you prefer, you can use our Repertoire app, which I designed specifically to make this process faster and easier. Repertoire has a huge number of features that will save you time and make it easier to keep track of evidence of each teacher's practice, which I'll explain in a separate section. Fifth, one way to increase the usefulness of your notes is to include timestamps. It'll be much easier to reconstruct the play-by-play of the lesson when you're talking with the teacher if each of your verbatim quotes and factual descriptions is accompanied by a precise timestamp. There's a big difference between, say, a disruption that lasts 1 minute and a disruption that lasts 10 minutes. We've built this feature into Repertoire, but you can also add timestamps using other programs such as Text Expander. Now you may be wondering, should I take this approach even for informal observations? If I just visit a classroom for 5 or 10 minutes, shouldn't I just leave a nice handwritten note for the teacher, maybe with a few compliments? Now, personally, I don't see anything wrong with that, but I don't encourage you to make that your main focus. The best time to leave a nice note is in your second or third visit, when you're staying long enough to have something to say, but it's still a new enough practice that you aren't ready to take detailed notes on your computer. Leaving a friendly handwritten note can be a nice gesture, and teachers will often hold on to those notes forever. But that doesn't mean you need to write a new note every time you visit. The reason teachers cherish these notes is that they're so rare. But if you're following the high-performance instructional leadership model, your visits to classrooms aren't going to be rare. And pretty soon, you're going to run out of easy compliments, and the impact those notes have is going to go down and down. Eventually, teachers are going to want the real deal, your actual observations, and they're going to get things out of those notes that you yourself didn't notice. So even though it may seem cold and informal to just email your raw notes to the teacher, it's actually very valuable for teachers to see what you saw, so that you can talk about the same set of facts and not just wonder why the other person doesn't see things your way. Another reason you might not want to make an ongoing habit of leaving a nice handwritten note or card for the teacher is that it's time-consuming and distracting to do that in addition to your documentation. And the more complicated we make this process, the harder it's going to be to keep it up. So my recommendation is, sure, leave one or two nice notes early on for each teacher, but after that, just start taking detailed verbatim notes on your computer and email them to the teacher immediately before you leave the classroom. Another practice I see all the time that I want to caution you against is sending the teacher reflective questions. You may have lots of questions after spending 5 or 10 minutes in the classroom, but a lot of those questions could be easily answered when you talk with the teacher, and a lot of them will be irrelevant to the teacher's goals for the lesson. And the teacher's current focus in terms of what they're working on to improve may be very different. We need to think about how the teacher will react if you send them a bunch of questions. Some people will take a quick look at the email and then do nothing. Other people will spend hours and hours writing detailed, thoughtful responses to make sure you end up with the best possible impression of them. Others will silently panic and worry about what's behind those questions, wondering what you're really thinking. And all of that is unnecessary. We may think we're just asking innocent questions to prompt reflection, but we're really causing an enormous amount of stress to teachers. So don't email your questions to teachers. Just send them your notes and let those questions come up in conversation, face to face. Now, I've made several recommendations in this section that conflict directly with many common practices in our profession. Right now, you're probably doing some of the things I just advised against, and that's okay. So what I'd like you to do is give me your honest feedback. What do you think about the recommendations I made in this video, about the idea of taking verbatim, low-inference notes and emailing them to the teacher? What do you think about leaving out the suggestions and compliments and reflective questions and just focusing on the facts? And most importantly, what do you find valuable about your current practices? Let me know what you've been doing and what you think about the approach I've shared in this video using the form below. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you in the next section. Why is it best to withhold judgment when you're observing a teacher? That's our focus in this section. When you're visiting classrooms, either informally or for a scheduled formal observation, and you take descriptive verbatim notes, perhaps with timestamps, you're capturing what actually happened in the classroom, not your opinions or judgments about it. In the short term, it's best to share those notes with teachers without any judgment applied, so that you can have a chance through conversation to make sense of what you saw. But over the long term, you'll start to draw conclusions about the patterns you're seeing, so you can give the required rating of each teacher's performance at the end of the year. It's important to be clear, though, that those judgments are about the teacher's overall practice, based on the patterns you're seeing in the evidence and how they align with your teacher evaluation criteria. They're not simply the sum of the scores of the individual observations. I get the impression that some people think of teaching like it's an Olympic sport, like the high dive or figure skating, where each performance is a self-contained event that can be judged and scored in isolation. We all have a vision of what an ideal lesson looks like, and that's fine, but we need to recognize that teaching doesn't happen in isolation, in these little self-contained episodes. Everything that happens in a classroom is connected to the unique history of that class and the experience of individual students and what they're doing over time. What happens during any particular observation, honestly, doesn't matter that much overall. We can have great days, and we can all have bad days, and what matters is the overall pattern, not any one day, and certainly not any 10-minute segment of a lesson that an administrator might happen to see. So we need to get away from this short-term scoring mindset, because we're evaluating teachers' overall practice, not their performance in the moment like they're an Olympic high diver. And when it comes to capturing verbatim, low-inference evidence, there's an interesting twist. Sometimes you'll have evidence about a teacher's performance that you don't realize is evidence at the time because you can't see the pattern yet. Or perhaps you'll realize that a pattern is forming, but you'll decide to collect more information before you can really judge the teacher's overall practice accurately. For example, let's say you're looking for evidence about the teacher's use of assessment, and you're referring to the Danielson Framework's Domain 3, Component D, using assessment in instruction. Now, during any particular observation, you're taking notes on what actually happened, but as you review those notes retrospectively, looking back over, say, 5 or 10 informal visits plus a formal observation, you might realize you have plenty of evidence to talk about that teacher's practice in the area of assessment. And then you might take a separate pass through that same evidence and look for anything you have related to Domain 3 Component E, demonstrating flexibility and responsiveness. And you might find in that same set of notes plenty of evidence that pertains to flexibility and responsiveness, even if you've never actually gone into an observation with the goal of collecting evidence about flexibility and responsiveness. And if you're working with a teacher evaluation tool that has a large number of criteria, you'll find this to be a huge relief, because it's impossible to focus on 20 or more criteria at once. So don't bother having look-fors that you're determined to see in a single visit, because the chances are good that you're not going to see them. Be patient, be consistent with your visits, and the patterns will emerge. When you're visiting a classroom and taking notes, just focus on capturing rich, descriptive evidence about what's actually taking place. Then you can go back through those notes later and see how it aligns with your evaluation criteria. But we can do even better. As you gain familiarity with your instructional framework, you'll be able to write your low inference notes using the language of your instructional framework. Now, it might seem like I'm contradicting myself since I just said not to try to rate or score the individual observation. But I'm still saying that. The way to use this language is in your low inference notes, as your vocabulary, as the way you write, and what you pay attention to. You're not going to apply a judgment in the moment, but you are going to pull that language from your framework and make that the terminology you use. For example, if you notice that students are using rubrics to check their work and make revisions to an assignment before turning it in, you could say just that. Students are using rubrics to check their work and make revisions before turning it in. Or you could look at your instructional framework and borrow some language from it. For example, Danielson Domain 3 Component D says in the Distinguished column, students appear to be aware of and there is some evidence that they have contributed to the assessment criteria. And it also says students self-assess and monitor their own progress. Now, not all of that may be true of what you're seeing right at that moment, but just being aware of what your instructional framework says can help you take much better descriptive notes. For example, you might decide, actually, I don't see any evidence that students contributed to these criteria. In fact, this rubric is straight out of the teacher's guide. But what you don't have to do is criticize the teacher on that point. There's nothing wrong with using a rubric provided by the curriculum, and you may end up with plenty of other evidence that this teacher does involve students in contributing to assessment criteria. So there are two keys to making the most of this approach. First, take descriptive notes only, and don't try to apply judgments or rate that evidence in the moment. You'll get to that later. Second, look at your instructional framework and use its language in your descriptive notes. Not all of it will fit, but if you strive to use whatever does fit, you'll develop a much sharper eye for what good instruction looks like according to your framework, and you'll be better able to capture the evidence you need and identify the gaps in your evidence. As you're probably thinking, this is an ambitious vision, and most instructional leaders don't fully take advantage of this approach. The main reason is that they simply aren't in classrooms enough. But you are going to be different. By following the high-performance instructional leadership model and getting into classrooms 3 times a day, 500 times a year, in addition to your formal observations, you're going to have vastly more evidence to work with and vastly more practice writing that evidence using the language of your instructional framework. Even so, though, it's hard to master the precise language of 20 or more criteria from your teacher evaluation system alone, not to mention the other aspects of your instructional framework, which you identified in Module 5. So I want to encourage you to use technology to make that language easy to access as you write, without shuffling pages and pages of documents around. That's why I've created Repertoire, and why I've included it for you in this program. Repertoire makes it easy to save your instructional framework language in snippets and templates, which we'll talk about elsewhere in this module. That's it for now. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you in the next section. I want to demonstrate now how you can use Repertoire, our web-based app that's included with your registration for this program, to take notes during your classroom observations using the language of your instructional framework. Now, there are lots of ways of taking notes, and you probably have a particular set of tools that you prefer. Maybe you're a pen and paper person, or perhaps you like to fire up Microsoft Word, or just a blank email. Or perhaps you use a more sophisticated tool like SIBME's Sync Notes that captures video alongside your typed notes in real time. Whatever tools are involved, though, you're essentially doing two things. You're paying attention, and you're writing down words. So far in this module, I've encouraged you to limit your writing to a very low level of inference, so that the notes you're taking are really just raw description, with no commentary, no reflective questions, and no scoring of any kind. But we've also talked about using language from your instructional framework in those notes to actually give you the vocabulary to precisely describe what you're seeing. This is something that's hard to understand without experiencing it for yourself, so I want to demonstrate that for you now in my app, Repertoire. Repertoire's number one feature is the snippet box, which works kind of the same way the Google search box does. If you start typing something into Google search, Google will use its massive database to try and predict what you're looking for, and it'll suggest the most likely matches, so you don't even have to know the exact spelling or type the whole thing. As soon as you see a match, you can just click on it. The snippet box in Repertoire works the same way, only rather than return search results from Google, Repertoire will return language from your instructional framework that you've imported. For example, let's say you're observing a class where students are using rubrics to assess their work, and you know your Danielson teacher evaluation criteria say something about that, but you're not sure exactly what. If you have access to the exact language your framework uses, you can be more precise, both in what you pay attention to and in what you write down. And of course, you can bring a hard copy of your instructional framework with you when you're observing, but it's very cumbersome to flip through a 10 or 20 or 50 page document to find the one or two sentences that you're looking for. But in Repertoire, it's as easy as a Google search. If I type self-assess, because I'm pretty sure my framework says something about self-assessment, Repertoire will pull up anything that matches. Then I can either just read it for my own reference, or I can actually insert that text into my observation notes. From there, once the text is in the message box, I can modify it so it fits what I'm seeing in the classroom. For example, I can take Danielson's text from Domain 3, Component D, from the Distinguished column, and rewrite that to say something like, "Students were clear on the evaluation criteria for their assignments, and they had clearly contributed to the design of the rubric. Students were self-assessing and monitoring their own progress." That way, I can make sure I'm documenting exactly the kind of evidence I'll need to be consistent with my evaluation criteria. Yet, unlike with a checklist, it's still richly descriptive. Now, there are a number of different ways you can get your instructional framework's language into Repertoire. The simplest is just to copy and paste from another document into the snippet box. Anything you type or paste into that box will be saved to your database as soon as you hit Enter. So this works even if you don't have anything set up in advance. But we can also help you import your framework language, so all you have to do is decide what you want to include. Think back to Module 5 and all the documents you compiled for your instructional framework. Whatever you'd want to see as a reference while you're taking your observation notes, we can import for you. If you have a frequency rubric with multiple columns describing each criterion and the degree to which it's evident, my recommendation is that you only import the highest level because typically that's going to have all the information in it, and it's going to be less confusing than if you have 4 or 5 different descriptions coming up for each criterion. However, if you have a true leveled rubric like the Danielson framework, where each column is qualitatively different, you may want to import all 4 levels. So you can do a quick search and see which level of performance has the language that fits what you're seeing most closely. I want to emphasize again that it's not our goal to rate individual aspects of individual observations. That's not how these rubrics are designed. They're designed to describe teachers' overall practice, and that's what we'll ultimately be evaluating. What we're doing right here is finding the right descriptive language so that when we review those notes later, we can see the patterns that are emerging because we've been deliberate about taking our notes using language pulled directly from the rubric. So I want you to take advantage of Repertoire. I've designed it specifically to help you implement the high-performance instructional leadership model, and I want to offer you personal assistance in figuring out what to import so you have exactly the language you need at your fingertips. Use the form below to send us any documents you're thinking about importing into your Repertoire account. Then set up a phone call using the calendar link below, and we'll talk through it and get you set up. If you need help with Repertoire at any time, you can go to repertoire.cc, where the app is located online, and use the live chat feature to get help with your password, importing snippets, or anything else. You should have a username and password along with links to our training videos in one of your welcome emails from when you signed up for this program. But if you need anything, just get in touch and we'll help you out. Thanks for checking out Repertoire. I'm Justin Bader and I'll see you in the next section. Back in Module 5, you compiled the key documents that make up your instructional framework, giving you a set of shared expectations for what good teaching looks like. Some of these expectations apply only to certain subjects or grade levels because they're curriculum specific, and others apply to everyone. For example, your school-wide expectations and teacher evaluation criteria. Now we're going to connect those expectations with the evidence you're collecting in your classroom visits. Ideally, your expectations are written in the form of rubrics with specific language describing different levels of performance. But even if you don't have rubrics for each expectation in your framework just yet, that's okay. What we're really looking for is the language, because that's what's going to allow us to triangulate. Triangulation is the name of the game here because we can't just score an observation unless we're using a curriculum-based rubric that's very specific about one particular aspect of teaching. Most of the time, we don't know going in what the purpose of the lesson is, so we don't know which of those ultra-specific rubrics we should use. There are a few exceptions, so let's get those out of the way. If you do have a well-defined structure that teachers are expected to always approach the same way, and you've done extensive training, and you've created a leveled rubric, and you've set expectations for how that particular aspect of instruction should look, then it is okay to score what you're seeing using that ultra-specific rubric. For example, if you use Lucy Calkins' Readers or Writers Workshop curriculum, and you've developed specific expectations for how mini-lessons should look, then it's okay to evaluate those mini-lessons using your specific rubric for them. Or if you've developed a bell ringer procedure that all teachers are expected to use to start class, you can evaluate the start of class in any teacher's classroom using that rubric. Usually, though, some of these essentials are missing, such as a clear rubric. Or, more importantly, what you're seeing during your visit isn't what you're actually evaluating. It's the wrong unit of analysis. As I've said earlier in this module, teacher evaluation criteria, such as the Danielson framework or whatever your district uses, aren't designed for evaluating individual lessons or parts of lessons. They're designed to help you evaluate teachers' overall practice over the course of the entire school year. So the bottom line is that we've got to get our unit of analysis right, and usually evaluating is not our immediate goal. A better goal that's useful in almost every classroom visit is triangulating. Triangulating is the art and science of finding the right language to describe the evidence in front of you, drawing your vocabulary and expectations from your shared instructional framework. This isn't our usual frame of reference as instructional leaders because we've been trained to evaluate. But triangulating is a bit different from evaluating. And to explain the difference, I think it's helpful to consider an analogy. Like instructional leaders, food critics have to triangulate as well as evaluate. Imagine you're a food critic for the Michelin Guide, and your job is both to write an article for the guide describing the food at a particular restaurant and to rate that food according to certain guidelines. Now, I'm not a food critic, so I don't know the specific terminology they use, but I'm guessing you can't write for the Michelin Guide and get away with phrases like, the food was spicy, or the ingredients were fresh, or the ambiance was fancy. Too clunky, not specific enough, and not the right way to use the precise vocabulary of the profession. But it also wouldn't work to just take the criteria and write a review that was 100% ratings and numbers. Even if those ratings were accurate, it's the descriptive language that really gives the review credibility and usefulness. And that's even more true for our work as instructional leaders, because we're not just trying to score our teachers. We're trying to evaluate them, yes, but we're also trying to lead them to get better and better. And that means a lot of the value is in the conversation. The conversation is where we establish agreement about the relationship between the evidence and the framework. It's where we use the specific vocabulary of our framework to create a rich description of the evidence that feels right, that fits. So again, most of the time, we aren't trying to evaluate in the moment. Evaluation will come later as patterns emerge. Our immediate goal is triangulation, to use the language of our instructional framework to talk about the evidence, usually in the form of our notes we took during the observation, with the teacher to establish mutual understanding and agreement. We can't always fully establish agreement on the final rating we give teachers, because ultimately that's a matter of judgment, but we're much more likely to arrive at judgments that are defensible and reasonable to teachers if we first triangulate the evidence with our instructional framework. In a separate section, I'll model that for you using a video from Dave's social studies classroom in Costa Rica. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you in the next section. In this section, I'm going to model for you the process of triangulating classroom evidence with an instructional framework. The video I'm going to share with you is from Dave Maycomber's 8th grade social studies classroom. And rather than show you my conversation with Dave, I'm going to show you the clip from his classroom and walk you through how I'm triangulating what's in the video with what's in the school's teacher evaluation framework. Now, a couple of interesting things about Dave's context. First, Dave teaches in an English-speaking school in Costa Rica, and most of his students are fluent in English, but it's their second language. Another unique aspect of Dave's school is their evaluation system, which was custom-built with the help of evaluation expert Dr. James Strong, so it's unique to their school. Unlike other examples I've shared with you in this program, Dave's evaluation criteria are based on a combination of the Marzano and Marshall systems. I'm not at liberty to share the full evaluation document with you, but the criteria I'm going to focus on are taken directly from the rubrics in Kim Marshall's book, Rethinking Teacher Supervision and Evaluation. These rubrics are available at marshallmemo.com, and I've included a direct link below this video. This particular rubric is what you've heard me call a frequency rubric, where there's really only one level of performance described for each criterion, and the different levels of performance are really differing extents to which that criterion is evident in the teacher's practice. So with this kind of rubric, it's a little more difficult to triangulate the evidence with the exact column because the language isn't really all that different from column to column. In a rubric with truly leveled performance indicators, like Danielson, there's more of a qualitative difference between columns, so it's a little bit easier to triangulate. On the other hand, while this rubric isn't as specific about how to distinguish between levels of performance, it's incredibly specific thanks to the number of criteria it has. 76 different criteria within 7 different standards for teacher performance. So it still gives us plenty of language for precisely describing what we're seeing. We're going to focus on just one standard in this video, which the school's version of the rubric calls Assessment of/for Learning. What I'm going to do here is show you the clip, followed by my attempts to triangulate what I saw with the language of the evaluation system.
All right. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. So on Tuesday, when we met last, we had our Columbus simulation. And I want to tell you how I thought you did on that, which was mainly awesome. But before I tell you how I think that you did, I want you to do a little reflection. So in a second, you're going to get on your feet. You're going to partner up with someone who is not at your table. And you're going to answer one of these questions. These questions are pretty familiar to us now. So I'm not going to repeat them again. These are our standard reflection questions for when we do an activity. So take a look, take 30 seconds to remind yourselves of the questions. Pick one that you're going to answer. And when I say go, you're going to get up, partner with someone from another table, and share your answer and listen to their answer. Got it? Thumbs up. Give me a thumbs up that you got it. I'm going to give you 30 seconds to think, what question do I want to answer?
Okay, so the thing that I like most about like all this was the simulation. I learned a lot about different people and groups, and also I practice talking and listening to my classmates.
The best thing about like the one I liked the most was that we could like interact with different people in our groups, and it was fun to see how other people reacted.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, the second piece of reflection we're going to do here is on our learning objectives that we set for our Columbus simulation. And I want you to, I'm going to give you some time to think about this too. Number one, for which objective can you say, I nailed that? Just nailed it. All right. And then which objective could be a growth area for you? Let me go over our four objectives. Number one, I can respond to historical documents, which you were provided on the Symbaloo. I can respond to historical events, actions, and themes using levels of Bloom's taxonomy. So I can summarize, I can examine, and I can judge. The second one was I can locate relevant information. So I gave you a ton of sources. Could you pick out and find what you needed to defend your group's position? Number three, I can work effectively as a member of a team. So, did you pull your weight? Were you respectful? Did you add value? All of those things. Or did you make it kind of difficult for your group to get done what you needed to get done? Last, and this was maybe the most important towards the end, I can communicate verbally and possibly in writing to effectively defend or attack a position. Okay, so on Tuesday, you all had to verbally attack or defend a position. All right, so to repeat one more time, you're going to share with a new partner when you get up and walk around. What did you just nail? What did you do really well? And what could be a growth area for you? I'm going to give you 30 seconds to think about that, and then we're going to partner up and share.
Okay, so what I think I nailed was being a good team member and contributing, because I wrote a lot, and when someone attacked, I defended pretty well, I think. And I helped my teammates when they were struggling to speak, since they're not fluent in English. Neither am I, but...
Yeah, you are.
I think I nailed the writing and defending, like writing and speaking to defend our team. I think I proved some good points, and I wrote down some stuff that could help us defend. And I think that I could learn a little bit to using Bloom's taxonomy.
Let's take the pulse of the whole group. So let's in the I nailed it category. If you feel like you nailed something, I want you to raise your hand. Number one, responding to historical documents, making sense of some of those primary sources. Who feels like they nailed it? I got one. Okay, I got maybe a two. That gives me a lot of information. We got more work to do. Looking at those primary sources and reading the writing of people when they wrote 600 years ago is tough. All right. I can locate relevant information. How many people feel like they nailed that? Okay. I can work effectively with the team. All right, I saw a lot of that during the days that I gave you work time to prepare for this simulation. I saw a lot of people working effectively as a team. That's awesome. Last, I can communicate verbally to defend or attack a position. Okay, so So you see we're different. All right, let's talk about growth areas, which I should be able to kind of figure out since it's going to be the opposite of what you just said. But growth area, looking at historical documents and making sense of them. Growth area? Yeah, so it should be a growth area for a lot of us. Locating information. Okay, I know what I need to support. Now I need to go out and find information to support it. How many people have that as a growth area? Okay, quite a few of you. Nice. I can work effectively as a team member. Is that a growth area for anyone? Good, that's a good sign. That's part of some of the hardest, one of the hardest targets in my opinion is to work as an effective member of the team. I can communicate verbally to attack or defend a position. I'm gonna work on that a little bit more. Okay, I'm gonna be giving you plenty of chances to do that this year. All right, awesome, thank you.
So in this clip, we see Dave leading his class to reflect on their experience in the Columbus situation they'd done several days prior, as well as their progress toward the learning objectives for the lesson. This clip is only 6 minutes long, but there's a lot going on that we can triangulate with our rubric. Since this lesson seems to be sort of an assessment, I'm going to focus on the assessment standard in Dave's teacher evaluation rubric, which has 10 different criteria, but we're going to focus on just two of them that give us some helpful language for triangulating. The first is C, which Marshall labels on-the-spot assessment. Does Dave use a variety of effective methods to check for understanding? Does he immediately unscramble confusion and clarify? If he doesn't, that's okay, because again, this is a rubric for evaluating Dave's overall practice across the entire school year. I'm not going to see all of this in every lesson. But I do see a few things in this clip that align with criterion C. First, did you notice how Dave asked his students to give a thumbs up if they understood the directions before the first partner discussion? Now, we didn't see any obvious confusion that needed to be unscrambled, but one thing I would have been looking for if I actually was in this classroom is whether all students were giving a thumbs up to indicate that they understood the directions. Remember how Dave asked students to give him a thumbs up if they understood? If some students didn't respond, then we don't really know whether they had any confusion that needed to be addressed. And if we look at our rubric, it actually calls thumbs up, thumbs down a mediocre method for checking for understanding and places that in the improvement necessary column. Does that mean that Dave is only at a level 2 in on-the-spot assessment? No, not at all. And this is actually where I'd start to second guess my rubric a bit. For example, if I go up a row and look at B, diagnosis, it says, does a quick KWL exercise before beginning a unit. That's under the improvement necessary column too. So as an instructional leader, now I have to decide how to triangulate my evidence with my framework. Does it ring truer that Dave, quote, uses a variety of effective methods to check for understanding, unquote, from the highly effective column, or that he uses mediocre methods from the improvement necessary column? It's only through repeated visits to Dave's classroom and repeated conversations with Dave so I understand the thinking behind what I'm seeing that I can get an accurate sense of this. Now let's look at criterion D, which Marshall calls self-assessment. Did Dave have students set ambitious goals, continually self-assess, and take responsibility for improving their performance? Again, because this is a frequency rubric, and I don't know exactly how often or how continuously Dave's students self-assess, I can't say for sure. But I do have evidence, based on this 6-minute visit, that Dave does have his students set ambitious goals, like making arguments about using evidence from primary sources in social studies class. And I know he has them self-assess and take responsibility for improving their performance. Did you notice how he asked students to raise their hands to share which objectives they nailed and which were growth areas toward the end of the clip? And did you notice how he corrected the student who said he wasn't fluent in English? He clarified, "Yes, you are," when the student was being too hard on himself. So when I talk with Dave, that's the language I'm going to use. I'm going to get him talking about how he helps students set ambitious goals, self-assess, and take responsibility for improving. And in that conversation, I can get a more intuitive sense of whether this is just how Dave does things, which would give me great confidence that Dave is in the highly effective column, or if it seems like a stretch for him to talk about any of this, I might start to draw a different conclusion. When you have the framework and the evidence in front of you, it all becomes clear, but not until the conversation, and often not until you've had several conversations over time. The more conversations you have with the teacher, the more you'll get a sense of their strengths and their areas for growth, because you're constantly comparing what you see in the classroom to what it says in your instructional framework. So now I'd like to ask you to go back and review Dave's clip from this video, but this time with your own instructional framework in mind. What teacher evaluation criteria or school-specific expectations come to mind? What descriptors or specific terms would you use as your vocabulary for talking about instruction with Dave? Look over your instructional framework, rewatch Dave's video, and let me know using the form below. In this section, I want to share with you my post-conference with Dave after a few minutes observing in his 8th grade social studies classroom. And this is a conversation that we had later, and it simulates the conversation that you might have with a teacher after school or possibly the following day. So let's take a look at our post-conference now. So Dave, I wanted to ask about when students were doing the reflection on the Columbus Project. I think the part that I saw was the day after they had gone through a big simulation, is that right? Or some sort of exercise like that?
Yeah, we had an 80-minute block period on a Tuesday where we did a big simulation. The kids were in 5 different groups and they had to argue. Basically, the premise was that Columbus is guilty for the genocide of the Taino Native Americans, but other groups were also to blame. So they had to sort of debate and say why their group wasn't as to blame as others and why they felt other groups were more responsible for that genocide. So they had to do a bunch of background research and then support a main argument with details and all the things we want kids to do when they're debating.
Yeah, and I noticed in your learning objectives, number 4 there, I can communicate verbally and in writing to effectively defend or attack a position. Was this the first time? I mean, obviously, this is kind of a heavy topic for are these 8th graders, 7th graders?
These are 8th graders.
8th graders. So kind of an intense topic. And was this their first experience doing that perspective taking and attacking and defending a position, or had they done that before in your class?
Not in my class, especially since we're early in the school year. But a lot of them participate in JMUN, Junior Model United Nations. So a lot of them had experience doing that last year. But yeah, I felt like I gave them a lot of time to research and to kind of frame their argument. And also I think, you know, 8th grade is definitely the first year that I think kids are mature enough to sort of talk about this kind of content. I wouldn't have done that simulation with 7th graders. Mm-hmm.
So notice so far, what I'm mostly doing is getting Dave to talk about the context of the lesson and fill me in on what I didn't see, as well as his thinking that went into this lesson. So let's continue, and I'll keep reviewing my notes so we're on the same page about what happened. And then I noticed the you had students respond to both the learning objectives, you know, to kind of self-assess based on the learning objectives, and to respond to 1 of 6 questions. And I wonder if you could tell me kind of what went into your decision-making about choosing that as a post-assessment, and if there were other kinds of ways that you were assessing that, maybe yesterday during the activity. Talk to me about your thoughts on the assessment there.
So I assessed them directly during the simulation with their verbal participation, and I also assessed them based on the note taking and the knowledge construction that they were able to do before the debate.
Now let's pause again and take a look at our rubric. In Dave's school, Performance Standard 3 is Assessment of/for Learning, and this is based on Kim Marshall's rubrics from his book Rethinking Teacher Supervision and Evaluation. The first 3 areas in this rubric are criteria, diagnosis, and on-the-spot assessment. So while Dave's talking, I can look down at my rubric and see terms like POST's criteria for proficiency, including rubrics and exemplars of student work, and diagnoses students' knowledge and skills upfront and makes small adjustments based on data, and frequently checks for understanding and gives students helpful information if they seem confused. So that's what I'm going to be looking for and potentially asking about as Dave talks. Let's continue.
The reflection that I did that's captured in the video was mainly to get feedback about how they, what they got out of the learning experience, what they liked, what they didn't like, suggestions for me to improve the experience. And then the second part was really more for them to reflect on their own skills and abilities and what they felt like went well and You know, a lot of them said they had a hard time finding and saying, okay, here's my argument. What facts can I find to support what I want to do? Some of them, you know, most of them, I think, said they worked well in groups. That was a strength area.
Let's pause here again and take a look at the next criterion in our evaluation framework. D is self-assessment. I see the phrase, has students set goals, self-assess, and know where they stand academically at all times. Right now, based on our conversation, I don't have enough information to really give Dave a rating, but remember, it's my job to evaluate Dave's practice over the course of the entire year. So for now, I'm not scoring this. I'm just looking for fit, for triangulation. Let's continue.
But a lot of them, you know, they're coming into eighth grade and they don't have necessarily a background in defending an argument. So this being the first time, a lot of them said that was actually a growth area, something that they didn't feel like they were really well able to do at this point, but they want to grow in that. And that's something we'll be doing all year in writing and in debating and group discussions. So, I guess I chose to do both because I wanted the feedback as a teacher for how I could improve my practice. And then I also wanted the kids to reflect on what went well for them and what goals they could set for the future.
Now I can see we've shifted a bit into talking about planning with students' needs in mind. So I'm going to jump to another part of our rubric. Standard A in Marshall's rubric is planning and preparation for learning. And there are a number of criteria here that we're touching on. Dave just told me his students don't have much of a background in defending an argument. And he said students identified that as a growth area and one they'll be addressing throughout the year. So I can see a number of places where this evidence triangulates with the rubric. For example, designs lessons focused on measurable, achievable outcomes aligned with unit goals. And plans for the year so students will meet high standards. And plans almost all units with big ideas, essential questions, knowledge, skill, transfer, and non-cognitive goals. So from here on, we're just going to let the conversation unfold organically, and I'm going to see what Dave says. I don't have a specific question I need him to answer or a specific answer in mind that I want to hear. I'm just having a conversation with Dave so I can learn more about his class, his students, and his teaching. So let's continue. Yeah, and that was another thing I was going to ask. For those four objectives that you identified, are those objectives that you'll have in other units as well, or are you trying to kind of hit hard on those in this unit and then move on to other ones, or do they kind of continue?
I tend to be a teacher who doesn't get too focused on content objectives. I really like the skills objectives more, and I think those will serve kids better in high school and college and life. So that'll be a skill that we go, you know, throughout the year, defending a claim, organizing your thoughts, organizing your writing. We'll be doing that all year. So this may have been sort of more of an initial assessment of their ability so that I can have a baseline to track their progress. And we'll be doing a lot of that this year. Yeah.
Good deal. Good deal. So kind of an ongoing yeah. set of skills to work on, huh? Yeah.
Yeah.
In terms of the responses that students gave, how did that kind of compare with what you had expected? Was it in line with what you'd expected, maybe from previous years, or just kind of your knowledge of your students and your curriculum, or were there some surprises in there?
Students love to debate. They love anything that has to do with, you know, friendly competition. So I wasn't surprised that they liked the activity. And I think, you know, any time you can give students a purpose to learn rather than just, hey, we're going to read this chapter in the textbook and then I'm going to quiz you on it. So I wasn't surprised to get that feedback. I think I was surprised maybe at how many kids said that this whole process of collecting evidence to support an opinion or defend an argument or to attack a position. I guess I thought knowing a little bit about them from seventh grade, even though I didn't teach them, I thought they would have maybe a little bit of a better ability to do that. So that was something that I can put in the back of my head to say, okay, maybe they don't get this as well as I thought they did. And that's something that I can kind of prioritize in my instruction. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and listening to students' reflections, I noticed that at least one student referred to kind of some language acquisition goals or some kind of practice in English, speaking in English.
Yeah.
Are the majority of your students English as a second language, or a significant number speak English as a second language?
A significant
language?
Number are, but a lot of them have been at the school since pre-K, so English is a second language, but by eighth grade, most of them are proficient, you know, and some of them are even highly proficient in English and in verbal and in writing.
Yeah, I noticed one student said, "I'm not fluent in English," and then you said, "Yes, you are. You definitely are." That's great. So it's something that they're kind of, it seems like it's something that they're kind of always working on secondarily to the content that, you know, that's always there.
Yeah. And I think, you know, whether you're in Costa Rica or whether you're in the States, I think the more that you can get kids speaking and collaborating verbally, the better, especially for those English language learners. If they're just listening to a teacher or working in a textbook, they don't get those opportunities all the time.
Right. Absolutely. All right. Any other takeaways or anything else you wanted to share that you recall or that you wanted to ask about, you know, from my perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I just felt like sometimes when I have kids go through that process of reflection, that sometimes it's too much at the surface level. And, you know, when I think, obviously reflection is a huge piece of instruction and it's a huge piece of learning for the students, but I'm always looking for better ways to do that. I thought the activity that I did with them was worthwhile, but sometimes, to be honest with you, I feel like I'm like going through the motions, like, okay, we reflected on that project, but I'm always looking for ways to deepen that reflection, especially when the students are reflecting themselves on what they did well and then maybe picking an area for growth. So I don't want it to just be like a box I'm checking, like, okay, we finished that project, now we're going to reflect and now we're going to go on to the next thing. So I'm always looking for ways to improve on that. So if you have any suggestions, that would be great.
Okay. Yeah, I was wondering, like, did you feel like there was a question that students could pick to reflect on that was kind of the easy one, or like versus one that gave you more information but also required them to think harder and get more focused on the content and their contributions?
Yeah, I think if I did it again, I probably would have, when I had those four learning objectives up there, I think I would have taken it a step farther where they said, you know, what didn't go as well or what's a growth area for you. I think I needed to take it a step farther and say, okay, so what specific steps are you going to take in this growth area to improve? Or, you know, what's your strategy? How are you going to sort of direct your own learning and growth and set some goals instead of just saying like, yeah, that was challenging for me. You know, and I think it's good for kids to talk about that, but I'm not sure there was like an actionable step for them moving forward.
Okay, so you're thinking kind of like, what's the goal setting that comes out of that reflection, and then what's the process to work toward those goals?
Exactly. Just make the goal setting a little bit more specific and actionable, and you know, I think it's good that we even reflected. I mean, some teachers just do the activity and they move right on to the next step, but I think you can always improve. So,
right. Yeah. And do you have written student work from this activity as well that you're assessing?
Yeah, so I have the organizers that they prepared before they went into the debate.
Okay.
And so I looked at those, and then I looked at the actual, I scored them as they were debating based on a scoring guide.
Okay.
So I scored their public speaking skills and their volume and their all that stuff, and then I also scored their ability to kind of think on their feet to defend or attack a position.
Okay. And is that kind of public speaking scoring guide, is that used in other classes as well, or is that yours specifically?
We have a presentation rubric that's used throughout our middle school.
It didn't quite fit
for this simulation activity just because it's so spontaneous and it's not a stand up and present to a group kind of thing. So I kind of adapted it to make it more more applicable to this activity.
Okay, good deal. And on the
So you said there were four learning targets that you wanted to work toward in this lesson, and you said those were kind of ongoing throughout the year. Is there a rubric for any of those, or are those mostly stated as objectives?
No, I have, especially for that writing to support a claim or arguing to support a claim, I have rubrics for that. So, four-point rubrics, developing nearly proficient, advanced, and that's all spelled out for the kids. Okay. Yeah.
Great. Well, thanks very much for opening your classroom to me and sharing this portion of the lesson, as well as your reflections. I certainly got a lot out of it and really enjoyed, being in your room virtually and talking with you today. So, Dave, thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Justin.
So there you have it. That's my conversation with Dave after briefly observing in his classroom. The original visit was just over 6 minutes long, and our conversation after school was about 12 and a half minutes long. It probably would have been a lot shorter if it was during his prep period, but since we had a little more time after school, I was able to ask some big picture questions about his curriculum and ask more probing questions about his goals for students and what he was trying to accomplish in this lesson. As we wrap up, I want you to notice what we did and didn't include in this conversation. First, while I looked at the rubric to see what criteria might be relevant for our conversation, I didn't mention that to Dave. You can certainly do that, but I want to encourage you to use your rubric as a source of vocabulary, not a rating tool. It wouldn't have been appropriate to say, you did X, and that's a highly effective on our rubric. Remember, these criteria are for evaluating Dave's overall practice, not one lesson. So our goal in referring to the criteria is triangulation, not evaluation. Second, I hope you noticed that the questions I asked almost always referred to specific things that happened in the lesson or specific instructional decisions that Dave had made. But those questions weren't worded very carefully, and that's okay. In a great conversation, often you don't even have to finish the question at all. You can trail off and just ask what we call a broken question to get the other person talking. The more open-ended your questions, the better insights you can gain from listening while the other person talks. I also want you to notice that Dave stayed pretty on topic here and talked about issues that lined up well with our evaluation criteria. You and I both know that doesn't always happen, and if Dave had started complaining about parents or complaining about students or otherwise shifting the focus away from his instructional decision-making, I would have had to bring it back with a more structured, evidence-based question. You may want to print out my 10 questions for better feedback on teaching, which you can download below on this page. Finally, notice that we didn't have any big action items or next steps. I didn't ask Dave to come up with a 3-step action plan to improve and promise to follow up in a couple of weeks. I'll be back in my next cycle of visits and we can continue the conversation. And Dave will continue working to get better because he's a professional. I don't need to micromanage that process. But if I do see a need to be more focused and intentional to bring about improvement in some specific area, I can always do that. Now, it's your turn. As you visit classrooms today or the next school day, whenever that is for you, have a conversation. Give this a try. Unless you're in your third cycle or beyond, don't take notes, but just pay attention and then talk with the teacher. Get the teacher talking. Ask open-ended questions and look at your instructional framework so you can triangulate your evidence with your teacher evaluation criteria and other school expectations. And rather than try to get the teacher to have some big breakthrough, focus on making it a rewarding and enjoyable conversation. You can see that I had fun talking with Dave, and I think most of the time, our conversations with teachers should be enjoyable. They don't have to be interrogations. They can be the foundation of great professional relationships. That's it for now. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you in the next section. How can you deal with teachers who have a higher opinion of themselves than you do? We'll talk about this from an evaluation perspective in Module 7, but we can make our jobs easier by laying the foundation now while we're still collecting evidence. Every school has a certain number of teachers who, for whatever reason, consistently rate themselves much more highly than you would. When it comes to the high-stakes final evaluation, it's understandable that teachers want to end up with the highest possible rating. And if their views of their own practice don't line up with the evidence you've collected, you've got to make a decision about how to handle that. Let's start by thinking about where these inflated self-ratings come from. I think it stems back to the old satisfactory, unsatisfactory days when there were really only two options. And even today, your evaluation system may have only two final ratings, satisfactory or unsatisfactory. We know that every teacher has room to grow, so I'm glad we're using better rubrics that give us more detailed information about teacher practice. But the fact is that many teachers still think in those binary, am I okay or am I not okay terms. And if that's your mindset, but your evaluation tool has four levels, you immediately go to the extremes and tell yourself either I'm perfect or I'm terrible. It's very hard to see the in-between levels as a viable option, because for their entire careers, teachers have had to justify themselves in order to end up on the satisfactory side. So how can we change this outdated way of thinking and get teachers to see themselves more realistically so they recognize the areas where they have room for growth and stop pretending that they're perfect at everything? First, a great starting point is to get teachers to actually look at the rubric to carefully read through their evaluation criteria. You might think about these criteria constantly as you're doing observations and evaluations, but teachers probably look at them as little as possible. So the truth is, they just don't have a good sense of what their evaluation criteria actually say. You certainly don't want their final evaluation to be the first time they've really paid attention to the criteria. As a principal, I always had teachers go through the rubric with a highlighter and highlight specific words or phrases that matched their self-perceptions. Most schools have teachers actually rate themselves in each area, but that's not my recommendation. I found that offering a little more flexibility to break it down to the level of individual words or phrases gave teachers permission to be more honest, to say, I have this characteristic of distinguished, but this characteristic of basic, and that's okay. Second, we've got to give teachers a sense of safety by creating a culture of evidence-based evaluation, so teachers know the final rating they receive will match the facts. Evidence-based evaluations protect teachers from getting bad ratings based on the unfounded opinions of their evaluators. The challenge, of course, is that we usually don't have very much evidence. We base our evaluations on the very small percentage of teachers' total instruction that we actually see, usually just 0.1 or 0.2%, just 1 or 2 hours out of the 1,000 or so hours that teachers are teaching in a school year. So here's what you can do to reassure teachers that your evaluations will be fair and evidence-based. Let them know that your default rating, unless you have specific evidence that pushes you into another column, is satisfactory. You might say, well, we need evidence to prove that the teacher is satisfactory, and I certainly prefer to have evidence behind every single one of my ratings, but the reality is, often we don't, and this cuts both ways. Teachers who have vastly overinflated opinions of themselves often don't have any evidence to support those opinions, and when we have negative opinions of teachers, often those are based on just a few specific areas of practice, and we don't have evidence that they're below satisfactory on many of the other criteria. So again, my recommendation is to get teachers to highlight the words in your evaluation criteria that currently apply to their own practice, so that they'll read the rubric carefully and they'll think about where they stand. Then, let teachers know that unless there's evidence to the contrary, they're satisfactory by default. If they want to be rated as distinguished or outstanding or highly effective or whatever your top category is, they need to provide evidence of that. And if you believe they're below satisfactory, it's your job to provide evidence to support that claim. Let's be honest, it's an incredible amount of work to compile evidence for each of the 20 or more evaluation criteria you may have, and teachers know that. So most of their fears that you're not going to be fair to them will be set aside if they know, unless you have more specific evidence, you're going to rate them as satisfactory in everything. And again, this cuts both ways. So the teachers who think they're distinguished or outstanding at everything will realize, oh, if that's what I want my final evaluation to say, I've got to provide the evidence. And often, they'll realize it's not worth the trouble. This greatly reduces the chance of conflict in the final evaluation process. We can't avoid conflict completely, but as we'll explore in Module 7, if we pick any fights in the evaluation process, we want to make sure they're the right fights. So start now in building a culture of evidence-based evaluation. Get teachers to highlight the rubric so they become familiar with the descriptors it provides, and let them know satisfactory is the default, and we only move out of that category if the evidence forces us to. That's it for now. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you in the next section. There's one particular type of evidence that you may need to compile very carefully, and that's evidence supporting a negative evaluation. We'll talk more about the formal evaluation process in Module 7, but before we move on from our discussion of gathering, discussing, and using evidence, we've got to talk about evidence of poor performance. First, let me say that I think teachers deserve to know where they stand and deserve every opportunity to improve. They also deserve to know what evidence you have about them, which is why I strongly recommend sharing your notes immediately after every visit. But because I believe teacher evaluation is an evaluation of the teacher's overall practice over the course of the entire school year, I believe you can and should do something that might at first strike you as sneaky or mean or even unethical. This is something that I don't share casually in emails or blog posts because there's too much potential for it to be misunderstood. But you've been with me for 6 modules now, so I'm confident that you'll hear me out, and I trust that if you do use this strategy, you'll do it with integrity. So here it is. If you follow the model I've been teaching in this program, you can build a substantial case about a teacher's performance without the teacher realizing what you're doing. The stronger your case is before the teacher realizes how much evidence they're up against, the easier your job is during most of what can be a very challenging process. That means you can do the bulk of your work, collecting evidence and helping the teacher improve, before the alarm bells go off and the teacher calls the union or files a grievance or does any of the other things that make your job harder. It's also better for the teacher because they're not in self-defense mode, and people are much more open to growth when they don't feel like they're under attack. So here's how you can approach your potentially negative evaluations differently so they don't feel like negative evaluations until you have plenty of evidence. It's typical practice in our profession for teachers to receive a rating after each formal observation. But I've been arguing throughout this program that an individual observation is not what we're evaluating. We evaluate teachers, not their individual lessons. So a single observation is just a chance to collect evidence. It's not the time to give a rating. Every time you're in a classroom, you're discovering another piece of the puzzle of that teacher's practice. But just like with an actual jigsaw puzzle, any one piece doesn't tell you what the rest of it looks like. You can't visit a classroom twice, score each observation, and then say with any sense of fairness that the teacher's real overall practice is the average of those 2 visits, any more than you can pull 2 pieces out of a jigsaw puzzle and average their colors together to figure out what the whole picture looks like. If you get a red piece and a blue piece, you can't say the whole puzzle is purple. It's more complicated than that because there's a lot more information that we simply don't have in the typical teacher evaluation process. That's why I've been challenging you to visit every teacher's classroom much more frequently throughout the entire year. So instead of just 2 pieces of the puzzle, you have something on the order of 15 to 20 informal, unannounced visits in addition to your formal observations. If after every one of those visits, you've shared your notes with the teacher and talked with the teacher and they've had a chance to fill you in on their goals for the lesson and any relevant context, such as how the lesson fits within the unit or what happened right before or after your visit, then you're in great shape. You have an enormous amount of information, and the teacher has all of that same information too. Now, here's where we have to be careful to use this process ethically. If you're truly keeping an open mind and just documenting everything so that you can see where the pattern of evidence takes you, and you're doing everything you can to help that teacher get better, there's nothing wrong with allowing that case to build without putting the teacher on notice until you have something pretty solid. But if you've already decided that this teacher is going to be unsatisfactory and you're not going to do anything to help them, that to me is unethical. If you've already made up your mind and you're not open to evidence to the contrary, you're misusing the process. But if you're willing to use this process ethically and do everything in your power to help the teacher improve, here's what you can do to make sure that you can get rid of the teachers who don't improve despite your best efforts. Simply do what I've been describing in this program. Visit every teacher you supervise in an ongoing rotation, 3 teachers a day. Get around to everyone in the same order as often as you can. And when you visit, take detailed, low inference notes about what you're seeing. Look at your evaluation criteria, which is easier if you're using our repertoire app to quickly bring up the relevant criteria, and take your notes using that specific leveled language. If you do this right, chances are good that the teacher won't see the pattern and you won't trigger their defensiveness. If you pull vocabulary from the unsatisfactory column of your rubric, but you don't say, "This is unsatisfactory," there's a good chance the teacher won't notice because you're describing what they're doing, not what they're not doing. That's what it means to have low inference, evidence-rich notes. Now, you can still communicate your expectations. You can still communicate your concerns. You can still provide support. You can still share those notes with the teacher immediately so there are no secrets. But lying dormant in those notes is language that you can activate later, like a seed that sprouts when you water it. And again, we have to be very careful to use this approach with integrity. If the teacher does improve and is truly in the satisfactory column by evaluation time, you don't ever have to water those seeds, and the teacher doesn't ever have to know that you planted them, which is much better for your relationship moving forward. But if things don't improve, you'll have acres and acres of seeds that you've planted, and they'll be ready to sprout at evaluation time. Now, it's important to point out that for severely underperforming teachers, Evaluation time doesn't usually mean at the very end of the school year. Check with your supervisor, but you can usually do a formal evaluation at any time, and certainly you should be able to do one by the middle of the school year. Don't wait to give a negative evaluation that needs to be given, but don't do the evaluation if you don't have the evidence you need to make it stick. Let me give a brief example of how to do this before we close, and I want you to notice how this approach is actually better for the teacher. Let's say you're using Kim Marshall's rubric, which I've linked to below this video, and you're working with a teacher whose classroom management is absolutely dismal. You hope it gets better, and you're doing everything you can to help that teacher get better. But along the way, you want to document, in no uncertain terms, how the teacher is currently doing. What most people would do is go to the rubric and use its specific language to rate the teacher or the lesson. For example, in Standard B, Classroom Management, there are 10 criteria covering things like expectations, relationships, respect, routines, and so on. Now, if you quote the does not meet standards column directly, it's going to be obvious to the teacher, and it's also going to make your notes less evidence-based. If you pull something straight out of the rubric, like is not respected by students and the classroom is frequently chaotic and sometimes dangerous, then the teacher's going to panic. But if you simply document verbatim evidence that triangulates with that description by describing what's actually happening rather than trying to characterize it as bad, the teacher's likely not to notice. For example, if your notes say, Mr. Smith gave the signal for the class to get quiet, six students continued talking loudly as he began giving directions. During the activity, students who were talking and did not hear the directions used materials in an unsafe manner. If that's what your notes say, Mr. Smith is going to say, yep, that's what I've been telling you, it's those six troublemakers. And if you've been using repertoire and timestamping all of your notes, those timestamps will make that triangulation even easier. If the teacher's wasting time or teaching in ways that are inefficient or ineffective, that'll become obvious in retrospect, even though you didn't put it that way in your notes. And again, this is a great kindness to the teacher if they improve. You don't ever have to do anything with those notes if it turns out that the overall pattern is good or if it at least improves to an acceptable level. But if the teacher does need to end up with a negative evaluation, you'll have everything you need because you've used the language of your teacher evaluation criteria to focus your attention on exactly what you need to document. Is that a little bit sneaky? Well, not really, because the criteria aren't secret and you're not keeping your notes a secret. And if the teacher compares the two and comes to you and says, oh no, I'm not doing well, can you help me? You're going to say, yes, absolutely. But chances are the teacher will never look at the rubric and compare it with the notes you give them. So use this carefully and use it with integrity. We'll talk more about the teacher evaluation process and how you can use evidence from your formal and informal observations to write better evaluations in less time in Module 7. That's it for now. I'm Justin Bader. Thanks so much for being part of this program and for the work you do every day on behalf of kids.